Chief Joseph Davis.
Here we go. Good morning. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order. Good morning, Monday morning, April 27th. We're going to start out with a public hearing on Senate Bill 272.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure modifies the general powers of the Board of Accountancy and the provisions regulating accountants reflecting best practices and the Uniform Accountancy Act. Establishes the Oregon Board of Accountancy Fund in the state treasury and continuously appropriates monies and funds to the board. Comes operative January 1, 2016, declares an emergency, no amendment, no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact, came across from the Senate on a vote of 30-0.
Wow, controversial.
Thank you.
We can make it controversial.
We could. Let's try.
Let's have Martin. I'm going to butcher your name already. Pidione. Wow. Scott Wright and Rob Moody.
Good start on Monday.
Good morning, gentlemen. If whoever wants to go first would introduce themselves for the record.
Hey. Good morning, Chair Representative Holvey, Vice Chair Representative Barton, Vice Chair Representative Kennemer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Martin Pitioni. I am the Executive Director for the Board of Accountancy, and I'm very pleased to be here before you today to testify very briefly on Senate Bill 272. I am not intending on repeating the full scale of what you have in writing either before you or on OLIS in terms of the testimony. I'll just want to very briefly summarize, and the committee administrator has already pointed out we have been unable to manage to bring your controversial bill. It's a 30-0 bill. So we have, in essence, worked with our stakeholders since fall of 2013 to really do a fundamental look at the statutes for the Board of Accountancy. And in essence, one key thing that this bill does is update them to reflect best practices that are encapsulated in the National Model Act, often referred to as the Uniform Accountancy Act, UAA. Beyond that, and there is one piece that the gentleman to my right, Mr. Scott Wright, Vice Chair of the Board, will testify. Encompassed in that is a critical update to the definition of a test, and Mr. Wright will testify to that piece. I simply want to give you a very brief four-bullet-point summary of, when I say updating, what that potentially entails in terms of potential changes in the board's authority, since that is probably the, you know, the piece that will that will probably be the one that you will pay attention to the most. One piece that we get out of this bill that's very important to us is that we were kind of really behind the curve in terms of rulemaking authority, i.e. current statutes of the board really only had some piecemeal references to rulemaking authority, and for regulatory boards, it's pretty standard that you actually have clear rulemaking authority for all the statutes that you're in charge of enforcing. That bill takes care of this. The second piece that's really important to us in here is that, and this is a little bit of a follow-up to a 2009 legislative bill. And back in 2009, Senate Bill 867 was passed, which essentially allowed licensees that are licensed in other states under what is commonly referred to as mobility to practice in this state with some caveats. What this does, this bill does, is that it adds to, it doesn't change any of that legislative policy. It simply adds on essentially an enforcement component that really, without getting into the complicated details, does something really essential for us, which is that we can say to you, if this bill passes, we can say to a board member or a licensee or a consumer that we have the same ability, if this bill passes, to hold a licensee from another state who's providing services to an Oregon consumer accountable the same way we can with a licensee that is licensed by the Oregon board. And that's a pretty critical update for us. And again, all of that has been negotiated with our stakeholders and has the full support of the profession and the community. The other piece, we finally get something in this bill that is quite frankly overdue. Many boards already have the authority to link to a provision of the Administrative Procedures Act, which allows you to emergency suspend licensees in particularly egregious cases. And we get the link to that provision in the Administrative Procedures Act under that bill. And then finally, we do get an update, which is also very common for regulatory boards already in Oregon, that we essentially get our own fund in a state treasury for the board. We have extremely outdated language that is, I think, at least 30 or 40 years old from what we could tell in the statutes, and we get those updates. So it's a lot of cleanup, no controversy. We worked really, really hard with a lot of folks for a year and a half to bring this to you without any major dissent. That's the extent of my remarks, and unless there are questions for me now, I would like to turn it over with the chair's consent to Mr. Wright on the definition of a test.
Go ahead.
Good morning. Chair Representative Holvey, Vice Chair Representative Barton, Vice Chair Representative Kinnemer. For the record, my name is Scott Wright. I am a practicing CPA. I am a partner with the firm Curtis Stokes down in Eugene. I am currently in my second term on the State Board of Accountancy. And as Mr. Puttioni talked about, part of a main piece of this bill is the updating, the statutory updating of the term a test, which is a term of trade used in the CPA world. In common day language, you might say certify, verify, confirm. Those are words that mean things in our profession. Historically, those have been applied to those terms have been applied to financial statements. That's a historical context. As the world is changing and evolving, our practitioners, the CPAs of the world, are being asked to do that verify, confirm, and certify of other issues. For example, sustainability, green practices, and things of that nature. The language of the Uniform Accountancy Act, which is covers all 50 states and many other jurisdictions, does at this time include language that would cover the certification or verification of such things as sustainability. Our practitioners are being asked to do that. In Oregon, we don't have that language right now. So really what this is to modernize the Oregon statute to bring it in conformity with what is happening across the nation at this point. It doesn't prohibit anybody from doing anything other than using language that might put the public in a state of confusion as to what practices they are using to verify a sustainability, as an example. It makes clear that if you're going to do it in accordance with standards established by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, you're a CPA that's doing it at that point. So it is not an attempt to keep anything out. It is a matter of public protection, so the public understands what it is that a person is, the procedures a person is doing to come up with that certification process. I want to thank you for the time. It's an update and modernization piece of the law.
Thank you.
Chair Representative Holvey, Vice Chair Representative Kinnemer, Vice Chair Representative Barton, and members of the committee, thank you. My name is Rob Moody. I'm a practicing CPA licensed in Oregon and a partner with the firm of Talbot, Crivola, and Warwick in Lake Oswego. And I'm basically here to follow on to the comments that you've already heard from the representatives of the State Board of Accountancy and simply urge you to pass this bill. What we believe in terms of the profession is that this bill will reinforce that language of a test and provide that basis for the reliance that's already there in terms of the public that we serve. So if there are no other questions, I'll be happy to, or if there are questions, be happy to entertain those.
Questions?
I just
Representative Doherty.
My husband was a CPA, and it's nice that you guys are here testifying instead of in Hawaii, which we usually were, that we can have after tax season.
Yes. The freedom of after tax season, yes.
Yes.
Somebody had to stay.
It's a small price to pay to not have to do taxes for me.
True.
So I assume, if I remember correct, that the Board of Accountancy is a semi-independent board?
No.
No. So what's the, I noticed that the fund that you're using now is in the access through the general fund. And in the future, it looks like this bill abolishes that and puts it directly into the Treasury under the control. So what's the dynamic of that as far as expenditure limitations and legislative oversight?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, great question. Actually, what this bill does is we are in the Treasury now. The technical term that I'm hearing from the DAS folks that I work with, because we're not big enough to have our own, you know, budget and accounting folks, so we're an agency that's called a DAS client agency. They use the term sub-account. So we are in the Treasury. This bill doesn't change that. Okay, it does not have anything to do with semi-independence. Semi-independence would mean that you're no longer part of the Treasury and you set up your own mm-hmm. bank account and a whole bunch of other things. That's not what these provisions do. So the change really for us is internal in terms of our relationship with Treasury. I've had conversations with Treasury on this, and quite frankly, I've been through the exact same transition when, and Representative Kennemer may remember this, back in 2009, I worked on a pretty major bill for social work. Senate Bill 177 in 2009 that had the exact same language that you have here before you in there, and it was also a Treasury internal transition where in essence you go from a sub-account within Treasury to your own account within Treasury. It's essentially just details, and it does allow us to earn interest on our money going forward, but it does not have anything to do with transition out from Treasury or semi-independence.
Okay. Any other questions? Not seeing any.
Mr. Chairman, just Representative Kinnemer. It was interesting to read the rather precise testimony. I couldn't resist. I'm sorry. I'm a psychologist.
And we are thankful
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Representative Widener, question?
Kind of a comment. But after Representative Kinnemer's comment, I mean, this bill is about as exciting as their profession.
Pretty exciting.
With that,
pretty exciting. You know, Arthur Anderson.
I apologize. But what some people there's just no answer for.
You knew it was coming to you.
Yeah,
right? Did you have a question?
Yeah. So thank you very much, gentlemen, for being here and presenting the bill. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 272. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 277.
This is a measure that authorizes DCBS to convert the money transmission, debt management service provider, and check cashing programs under the into the nationwide mortgage licensing system and registry. Allows DCBS to modify by rule the licensing practices, procedures, and information to meet the registry requirements. It aligns licensing or registration statutes in each program area to be based on the calendar year for the first year licensing or registration and subsequent renewals. Declares an emergency. Becomes operative 91 days after the effective date. There's no amendment. There's no revenue. There's no fiscal. And the vote on the Senate was 29-0.
Thank you. Could we have Rick Blackwell and David Tapman? Good morning, gentlemen.
Mr. Chair, good morning. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, David Tapman, and on my left, your right, Richard Blackwell. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, and Mr. Blackwell is our legislative coordinator for our division. We come before you today regarding Senate Bill 277, and I'm sure Representative Widener will see that this is not too different from the last matter. It's a rather dry and more formulaic issue than anything substantive. No policy behind it. The issue before you is that we're asking to have the authority to allow 3 of our 15 programs to be licensed through the national licensing system that was established under the SAFE Act. The SAFE Act is the Secure and Fair Mortgage Lending Licensing Act of 2009 that Congress instituted in response to the economic crisis that we had suffered under in 2008 and going forward. It was in an effort to come up with a uniform standard and a uniform approach for licensing mortgage lenders and mortgage loan officers. It has proven to be very successful. All 50 states have adopted that. In Oregon, for instance, we have over 130,000 mortgage loan officers using it, as well as 16,000 mortgage brokers being licensed in it. So it's a great system. It's been proven to be well constructed, and it allows for a lot of uniformity for these companies, particularly national companies that have to license in multiple states. So you get one application, one renewal process, a single date for renewal, a single place for filing your annual reports. It also allows for all regulators to go to one single source for information, and maybe most importantly, it allows for consumers to go to a single source to get information about individuals' licensing, testing, and enforcement actions or complaints. As you see, we're asking to include 3 different types of entities within this. As I mentioned, our mortgage lending program is already under the NMLS system, as well as we've adopted rules to bring in our consumer finance companies. And that has proven to be very successful. All of our consumer finance companies have transitioned into this, and with the exception of one, all renewed on the system. So it's proven to be useful in that regard. The reason we're here is because of statutory requirements that do not line up well with the SAFE Act. So the SAFE Act requires annual renewal. Some of our programs have biennial renewals, and many of the companies have renewal dates are dependent on the day they renewed. So if a company licensed in April, then the renewal date would be in April. If they licensed October, the renewal date would be in October. This would establish a single renewal date or a single application and renewal date, and that would be the first day of each year. So we think that makes sense. It allows for uniformity for the different entities. Oregon is certainly not out there out on a limb in this case. As of 2014, 38 state agencies have adopted using the NMLS system for multiple types of licensing programs. Over 100 different types of non-mortgaging programs have been licensed under this. So we think this makes good sense. It's useful for the industry. It helps us. By the way, many of our smaller licensees, and these are small programs for us, are on a program that is at an end-of-life computer system. And we will have to, if we don't turn to the NMLS, we'll have to purchase a new off-the-shelf system or create a new system. To us, this just makes more sense than going and buying a new program that would be limited for these 3 entities. So we think it makes fiscal sense, and we think it makes good public practice sense for these companies as well as for the public. There's one other matter that may be of some interest to you, and that is within the breadth of the bill, we have money transmission. And money transmission is nothing more than licensing individuals who send money back and forth. Most of us think of Western Union or PayPal or other companies that have somebody will send money, usually across the country or even out of the country. But what we have seen is in this new world that there are a lot of businesses that we're calling cryptocurrencies. Those are businesses in which they're engaged in shipping something of money-like value between people. The most common one would be Bitcoin, but there's, dozens and dozens and dozens of these cryptocurrencies. And many of them have asked to be licensed with us under the money transmission law to provide some assurance to consumers that there is some oversight, and should something not work, that there's a recourse so that the consumer can turn to government entity to ensure some compliance. Under our current definition of money transmission, it only talks about money, and there is no definition of money. So we're asking to define money to include currency, but also to include these cryptocurrencies, these non government non-fiat established values. And again, Oregon is not out on a limb by itself here. As you probably have heard, state of New York has got an entire regulatory program they just adopted this year to regulate cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin. New Jersey is in the process of doing the same thing. California, by rule, is looking at doing this. And so it's just it's a reality of where we are today. We think it makes good public policy to include these cryptocurrencies. That doesn't mean that we're somehow legitimizing them and saying that they're now going to be a substitute for U.S. currency. We're just saying we think that what people of the public are using, this regulation makes sense. And so we're going to try and catch up with where the industry is moving and where I think the industry is asking us to be. So with that, I'm going to conclude, unless there are questions, or Mr. Blacklow may have some follow-up points.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, just for the record, I'm Rick Blackwell. I have nothing more to add except that the figure for the 130,000 mortgage loan originators is actually a national figure. So we have probably less than that, but it's the amount of people that are licensed across the country. So other than that, I conclude. So
thank you. Questions? So the fascinated by the regulation of cryptocurrency. So it's not a currency from any individual nation, I assume, but is it being recognized as a currency and as such?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes. As I mentioned, the state of New York has got a full-blown registration process in place. They've gone to great lengths to try and figure out a way to not just identify cryptocurrency, but to regulate and to some degree promote it. I don't know where it's going. I hesitate to venture a guess. I don't have that kind of insight and clarity, but it doesn't seem to have gone away in the last 3 years, and don't know whether it will continue. Speaking personally, I'm not sure Bitcoin will be the ultimate test, but I think some form of cryptocurrency will continue to exist because it has proven to be useful for a number of people within society. There has been some talk of even finding systems that duplicate that for the government's payment processing system. I don't think the Federal Reserve is ready to adopt Bitcoin as a substitute, but I do know they're looking at ways that allow for payment processing and the movement of money within less than 24 hours, which is one of the benefits of Bitcoin. It's almost instantaneous as opposed to money transmission, which can take days. And if you think about the three-day requirement for clearance of checks, processing of payment is behind the times from where it could be. And so I think Bitcoin or cryptocurrency in its generic form will continue to probably develop, and who knows what it'll look like. But I suspect something along the lines of what we're seeing now.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the Board of Accountancy left, but I'm kind of curious, you know, how the IRS is going to be tracking who's paying the taxes on Bitcoin transfers.
Well, Mr. Chair,
something in your realm?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no, I can't say that. I think the IRS will have to make that decision themselves. I believe they are not ready yet to accept that. But if you've gone to Portland and in the Pioneer Shopping Center right off of Pioneer Square, there is a Bitcoin exchange where you can go in and exchange dollars for Bitcoins and vice versa. And so to me, when commerce reflects a trend, I think that's an indication there's something there more than just a passing fad.
Thanks. And one other question, I was just noticing that in the language it does mention debt management services. Is that something that's also going to be on this registry?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, that's correct. It will be on there. And again, we have about 72-73 debt management service providers, and we think that's a good thing. We have, as you well know, numerous entities that are not licensed to do this, and we continue a pretty aggressive fight to stop the practices. We've seen improvements in that area. But they continue to be a problem as long as people are still facing debt problems and collection problems. So to the extent that legitimate companies want to come in and get licensed, they'll be able to use the system.
So, and of interest in the tax world again is I see these ads on late night TV a lot of times that are advertising settling my tax debt and working Are these entities debt management services, or are they something that's under the realm of the Board of Accountancy?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that's a fascinating question.
Because that's twice today you've gotten that.
And that your obligation to pay taxes isn't necessarily a debt, as opposed to when you borrow money, that's a debt. When you use your credit card, that's a debt. But when you have an obligation to pay taxes, there's some debate whether that's a debt or whether that's an obligation to pay something that the government has charged you with paying. And so we think it's not very clear. I will say this.
So the IRS doesn't send debt collectors out?
That may be a different issue. They may choose a different name than debt collectors, Mr. Chair. I do know this. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau recently came down against one of these entities that is involved in refund anticipation loans. But then that's slightly different than those who are going to help you with your obligation. We've not taken that issue on. It's not clear that it fits directly within debt management service providers.
On TV, they do call it tax debt. So anyway, maybe I'll have some further conversations with the Board of Accountancy at some point about this, because it's very concerning to see, you know, how they advertise and how they're claiming that they can reduce your tax debt by, you know, 50% or, you know, whatever. And I just find it sort of interesting anyway. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does this include mortgage servicers?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Esquivel, there is actually a bill that is right now leaving the Senate that would pick up, give us authority to register and license and regulate loan servicers, mortgage loan servicers. Currently, the state of Oregon does not have our agency or anyone in the state, does not have authority over loan servicing. They are excluded by statutory definition.
Follow up. That's desperately needed.
I couldn't agree more.
Desperately needed.
We hope then you'll
put that on the list with tax debt.
Put the tax
management
debt. You have
services
to have over $10,000 in debt, though.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Esquivel, if we have a chance, we hope that that bill will come in front of you, because we agree it's desperately needed.
Thank you. Well, we've exhausted this. Is there any other questions on this fascinating bill? Thank you very much presenting it to us this morning. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill or Senate Bill 277. And open a hearing on Senate Bill 578.
Mr. Chair, committee members, the measure permits the insurer, under certain conditions, to post the insurance policy and the endorsements on the insurer's website in lieu of mailing or delivering the insurance policy to the insured. There are no amendments, there's no revenue, there's no fiscal, and the vote in the Senate was 29-1.
Thank you. Let's see, is somebody signed up for this one? Tom Barrows.
Mr. Chairman, I stand up and make a comment.
Certainly.
I just wanted to thank Mr. Barrows and others for talking in advance with me about this bill. I get jumpy on such matters, but this is a good bill.
Why rest easier now? Thank you. If you'd introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom Barrows, representing Progressive Insurance here in support of Senate Bill 578, which would allow insurance companies to post the online the general provisions of an insurance policy, not specific to individuals. If this passed and a company decided to set up this kind of option, when you sign up for insurance, we send you a packet of information, including your declaration page, which has your personal information, and then a whole bunch of boilerplate to legalese that often gets recycled or thrown away rather than filed away as it should be. Under this bill, when you receive your declaration page, you would also receive instructions on where you could go to see the rest of that information online. Or if you would like a hard copy, we would send you one at no cost yourself, either a 800 number or an email address that you could request that at no cost. So it really wouldn't change much. It just sort of brings us into the electronic age where a lot of people prefer to have their information online. After the policy expires, it would require that it be archived for 5 years. And that's kind of it, kind of another dull bill. Be happy to answer any questions.
Questions, Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom, is this personalized example? You look at the people up here, and each one of us has different types of policies. Now, does that give me access to this plus a password in order to get one specifically that I have purchased, or how does that work?
Mr. Chair, Representative Esco, my understanding would be that it would be the information you would receive on where to access this email would be specific just to that policy. People may have different policies, and it would be just the boilerplate language, nothing that's personalized to any individual. So you wouldn't have access to anyone else's. That's all on the declaration page that you would get in the mail that has your personal information. Everything that's posted would just be the generic legalese specifics to that policy, but not to your individual information.
Other questions? Thank you, Tom.
Thank you very much.
That I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 578 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 715.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the measure permits licensed insurance providers to be the licensees for products that are distributed through non-insurance travel retailers if the specific conditions protecting consumers are met, including registration of the agents, training, and consumer disclosures, declares an emergency, there's no amendment, there's no revenue, there's no fiscal, and the vote in the Senate was 30-0.
Thank you. Mr. Gardner. I assume you're signed up.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I am appearing today on behalf of the U.S. Travel Insurance Association. Senate Bill 715 would update Oregon's producer licensing requirements for travel insurance to bring it into conformity with over 30 other states. The bill uses language based on a model act adopted by NCOIL, the National Conference of Insurance Legislators, and uniform licensing standards adopted by NAIC, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, in 2010. Washington, Idaho, and California have all addressed this modernization, and legislation is currently being pursued in Nevada. There was no opposition on the Senate side or on this side, and we have briefed the insurance commissioner about this legislation, and she has no problems with it. She has asked us to assist with the drafting of implementing regulations, and we're delighted to oblige. Let me just provide a brief statement of the rationale, the need for this legislation. Travel agents and insurance companies writing travel insurance have in recent years faced disparate licensing requirements in each state. Before states started enacting this model act a couple of years ago, there were 41 different licensing qualification codes to get licensed for travel insurance across the United States. Each state had different licensing processes and procedures, and some did not accept electronic applications. As a result, it could take 6 months to get licensed to sell travel insurance across the U.S., making full compliance nearly impossible in an industry that can suffer very high turnover. And I'm speaking of travel agents. Mm-hmm. This posed a significant burden and regulatory risk to the 155 travel agencies in Oregon, which provide more than 800 full-time jobs and millions in direct economic impact to the state. Compliance burdens weigh heavily on these predominantly small businesses, with 75% employing fewer than 5 people and 90% fewer than 10. This legislation would permit licensed insurance providers, the companies, to be the licensees for products distributed through non-insurance travel retailers, i.e. travel agents, if and only if specific new conditions protecting consumers are met, and those are specified in the legislation. Registration of the agents, training, and consumer disclosures, all set out in the bill. The American Society of Travel Agents, which represents travel agents in Oregon and across the country, joins USTIA in support of this legislation. And I'd be delighted to answer any questions you might have.
Questions, Representative Burton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, thank you for your testimony. It made sense to me. A question that perhaps and you might be able to speak to, you might not. Generally speaking, when there is a uniform law that is endorsed by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, we have the insurance commissioner or somebody from DCBS being the primary proponent of that bill. Here, it seems that that has been left to industry alone. Do you know why that is? It strikes me as unusual.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, I really don't. We did meet with the commissioner and her staff, went through the bill. As I said, they expressed no issues with it beyond asking for assistance in helping to draft up implementing regs. So perhaps their feeling was that that we could adequately present the issue to your distinguished committee.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, just like to thank you for bringing this bill to us and all the work that you've done on it. It's an important issue. Just wondering, has anybody been hit for not having this law in place, or is there been a circumstance where someone's got kind of caught off guard when they were selling the insurance in the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, I am not aware of specific enforcement issues. I know that the industry feels that there is the possibility of regulatory risk because of the factors that I mentioned, the high turnover, the nature of the travel industry. So I think it's what I'm aware of is that there's a perception of regulatory risk. I'm not aware of specific enforcement incidents.
Other questions? Not seeing any. Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else that wanted to testify on Senate Bill 715? Not seeing any. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 715. And committee, we're not going to move any of these bills today. And so with that, I will adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor. House Committee on Business and Labor.